welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Haley Krischer. Haley is the author of the adult novel, Where Are You, Echo Blue?, and the YA, young adult novel, Something Happened to Ollie Greenleaf and the Fallen Girls, and her new book, what we're talking about today, You Belong to Me. Haley is an award-winning journalist who has written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, Elle, Writer's Digest, and more. She has an MFA from Lesley University and lives in New Jersey with her family. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Haley.
Thank you so much for having me.
So did you start out as a journalist and then moved into writing novels, or did you do both all along?
Well, I started at Northeastern University as a journalism major, and I actually in their co-op program, which is a fantastic program, I worked for the Boston Globe. And so I had always been writing stories from when I was a young kid, but I also was fascinated by journalism and telling other people's stories as well. And so I think I always combined the both. And then by the time I got to the end of my sophomore year, I realized at Northeastern, I realized that I wanted to learn the classics and read the classics and study them. And so I transferred to NYU, which is where I graduated. So I think I always have wanted both of those things. And I started doing a lot of writing at when I was at NYU, and that's actually when I first started writing my first book, Something Happened to Ollie Greenleaf, which started as a short story. And at the same time, I believe I might have been also writing for the school paper there as well. I know I wrote for a number of weekly newspapers in New York, which don't exist anymore. I think I always combined the both.
How does one kind of inform the other, or what skills do you take from journalism into your novel writing and vice versa?
Well, it's such a good question, because I realized about myself in the past couple of years that I just love researching, and I also love characters. And so I love researching real stories and elements about people and how they make their decisions. And so I would say all of my books have been based on real events typically tragic events. Unfortunately, for my last book, Where Are You, Echo Blue?, I actually was able to sort of combine all of those things together. It's about the most famous child star of the 1990s who disappears on the eve of the millennium, and the journalist who also happens to be an obsessed fan who goes looking for her. And, when I first started writing that book, I was really just fascinated by child stardom, and especially the dark side of child stardom. And I had interviewed a number of celebrities for the New York Times. And I thought that, okay, this is my dream job. I'm like finally like combining all of these things together, my fascination with celebrity and, writing for the New York Times. This is it for me. And then I interviewed Tatum O'Neill, who I was a huge fan of hers as a child growing up, and just always, I think she's the kind of person that everybody roots for, because she just had been through so much. And she had this tumultuous relationship with her very famous father. And I mean, Tatum is still the youngest person to ever have won an Oscar. She was 10 years old, and it was for her role in Paper Moon, which is a fantastic movie. And it stars her and her father, and she was only 8 years old. And so I think between her and there's a point to this long-winded answer, I promise. But my point is that I was always fascinated by her as a real person, and fascinated by her relationship with her father, And also, as well as fascinated by just child stars in general and sort of the psychology behind them and how they deal with real life situations, because there's so many problems in that industry. And so I wanted to write about that, but I also wanted to be able to make sure I told this fictionalized story. And so I used sort of some of my own stuff about being a fan and feeling uncomfortable about interviewing her, and am I asking her personal of questions, and am I, you know, and why is it my job to speak to this vulnerable, you know, woman, when why does she have to like sort of disclose everything to me? And I found that really interesting, and which is where then I started creating this character of the obsessed fan who happens to also be the journalist. And so together I was able to really like kind of put all of my interest in research, my interest in real people, and then my own interest in fictionalizing everything. And so that's the answer to your question. I think I really love to mix all of that together.
To bringing it all
I've
together.
Done that in my other book.
Yeah. So is Tatum O'Neill still acting?
You know, she's not still acting, unfortunately. She had a stroke a couple of years ago.
And
maybe she will act. It's not to say that she won't. But I think that they've been working on a documentary for her, she had told me recently, which is great because she deserves all the accolades that she gets. She's an amazing actor and has been through a lot.
You know, I was just reading an article in Vanity Fair about Millie Bobby Brown, who seems to have escaped the horrible effects of child stardom to some extent. And I think partly it was having strong parents who really supported her.
Well, I think that's the key, because when you look at people like Jodie Foster or Natalie Portman, you forget that they were child stars, but they were. And they went to college, you know, and Brooke Shields was another one who had a very abusive mother, you know, real narcissistic, abusive, alcoholic mother. And somehow Brooke Shields was able to tell herself, I need to go to college. I need to stop being, you know, the focus of all this male and female gaze when she was like only 13 years old. I mean, she had such a crazy life. And so it's amazing when you see that people can like pull themselves out of it. But I think probably a lot of them do. I think we hear the stories about the most salacious stories, but it's hard not to, because when you see a child star on screen or in television, you really like connect with them. And you really relate to them, because I think child stars, they all give us hope, because they're like this fresh, young,
innocent.
You know,
they have innocence.
Yeah, they're innocent.
Yeah. So, and this is kind of leading into the book we're talking about today, You Belong to Me.
Yeah.
Because nowadays it's almost easier for a parent to push a child into becoming a celebrity through the social media.
Yes.
You don't even have the gatekeepers in Hollywood to deal with. You just, you know, not that it's easy to attract attention in social media and get followers and so forth. I mean, somebody has to really put a lot of effort into making it happen, but it seems pretty prevalent. And what is it doing to these kids?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, this is, you know, the studies show that, you know, Instagram and TikTok and, you know, Snapchat, they're really affecting our girls more than anybody else, especially with anxiety, and because you're constantly looking at yourself and judging yourself and critiquing yourself. It's not normal to be like staring at yourself all the time, even what we're doing right now by like doing Skype, right?
Right.
Like we're looking at ourselves and you know, usually you would have like a regular or you would maybe sit and talk to somebody and you would just look at their face, but you wouldn't look back at your own face.
Well, that is true. It's true.
You know, and so it's a very challenging thing, because when you're growing up and you're young, it's not even just for young people. I think that, you know, everybody is affected sort of by this constant staring at our face, our own faces, and what we expect from ourselves and want from ourselves, and the false expectations that we have, you know, by looking at, you know, sort of, you know, this other kind of glamorous world. And, you know, and You Belong to Me, I really wanted to explore that, you know, dark side of the wellness and beauty industry, where, you know, where these kids are thinking, okay, maybe I can have a magic pill to, you know, make myself look better or feel better. And, you know, in this case, You Belong to Me is about a high school girl named Frances Bean, and she falls in love with the daughter of a wellness guru. You know, and she and all of her friends are these goth kids who, you know, have their own look, but they wear all black, and you know, they're very smart, they're intellectuals, they run the school paper, but they're not necessarily, you know, trying to make themselves fit into a traditional beauty and what traditional or classic beauty looks like. And so they see, you know, Frances Bean is this outsider, and she's the teacher's daughter. So she goes to this very elitist school, and she feels like an outsider with her friends. Even though her friends are happy to be outsiders, she's really not, because she already feels like an outsider along with them. Because, like I said, her mother's a teacher. She only goes to this elite private school because her mom works there. And so then when she starts getting a crush on this wellness guru's daughter, her name is Julia, and she sees all of the beautiful images online of the wellness company in this book is called Deep. When she sees all of Deep's, you know, all of the pictures of the images, all the girls who work there wear white. They all have beautiful skin. They all are like walking through the grass barefoot and the meadows and the Queen Anne's lace. And she's like, oh, that's what I want. That kind of beautiful freedom. And so she gets, you know, drawn into this world where everybody looks amazing, you know, and she starts using all the Deep products and her skin starts to change and she starts having good skin. But then all of a sudden they start using a lot of cult-like tactics, which a lot of influencers do and a lot of wellness and marketing companies do. And they love bomb her with tons of compliments. A few weeks later, they start to really tear her down. They isolate her from her friends. They control her wardrobe. They tell her she's only allowed to wear white. And soon enough, someone dies, and there's a lot of older men hanging around, and there's a lot of deception and manipulation. And Bean starts to realize, wait a second, am I in a cult?
Now, is there a particular real life incident or company that this is based on?
It's really a lot of, I was always fascinated, and I always had a love-hate relationship with a lot of the celebrity wellness companies, which I won't name names, but I think that you could probably guess who,
like,
I'm
starts
talking
with
about.
G and ends with P,
maybe. Can't confirm, can't deny. But there's a lot of them. It's not just that one. But I think that there's an element, you know, I mean, I will say that, you know, in an article in the New York Times, I will say that that company, Goop, who I'm not saying that this is based on, but, you know, Goop was supposed to do some sort of newsletter with and website with Vogue. And Vogue wanted to be able to do fact checking on that company. Because that's what Condé Nast, the publisher of Vogue, that's how they work. You have mm-hmm. to actually, You can't just make things up and put it in that magazine. It actually has to be fact-checked by real people. You know, like I said, according to the New York Times, Scoop didn't want that. Scoop said, no, we can't do this. We can't do this newsletter with you or this website with you because we can't be fact-checked. And so I think that, and that's, you know, somebody else wrote that in the New York Times a number of years ago. And so I think once you see that, and once you realize that the wellness industry really has very, very little regulation, you could literally put wellness on anything. You could put the word clean on anything. And you could put the word organic on anything. And there's just not many, you know, there's not any real pushback to that.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I'm in the fragrance industry, home fragrance, home and car fragrance, and aromatherapy, essential oils. You know, there are real definitions of those, but you see something in the marketplace that says it's aromatherapy, it means nothing.
No, right.
Yeah.
Right. And so
it means it smells. That's all it means.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't have to be like lavender. That is.
It doesn't have to be pure
oil.
Essential oil. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't have to meet any real requirements.
Yeah. And I think that there are probably some reasons for why some of that is happens, not just because of lobbying. I think there's a lot of Chinese medicine that, you know, a lot of things started that, you know, holistic, you know, sort of, you know, the wellness world has like a big history and actual holistic practices that, you know, as you know, I mean, that
right.
stem from alternative, you know, an alternative industry. And
that can be beneficial.
That can be really beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've been in that world since the 90s because I worked at a couple of different health food stores when I was in my 20s. One in San Francisco and another one in New Jersey. And neither of those stores exist anymore, obviously, because like Whole Foods has taken over everything. But, you know, I think that there are real benefits to so many of these practices. I mean, I love acupuncture and, you know, I just started going to Reiki this year for the first time, which I don't know what it does or if it works.
It's funny you should say that because I was just thinking about, I had a couple friends who did Reiki and I just was thinking, flashing back this morning to a very, very difficult time in my life where they came and did this Reiki treatment on me and how, you know, that it did help. But you know, why?
Right,
I don't know.
Why? We're not sure. And like our energy, the Reiki master's energy going into our energy and, you know, none of that is scientifically studied. And if it is, it probably is, you know, nothing is, you know, my point is that you could see that there are some areas that are a little gray in the wellness industry. But I think that because the wellness industry now is a $6.3 trillion industry and is going to be $9 trillion by like 2028. It is such a place because we live in a capitalistic society, you can make a lot of money.
Right.
And anybody could say that they're a guru like, you know, Dina Patterson, who runs Deep, you know, who's the wellness guru in my book, You Belong to Me. Anyone could say that they're a guru, and what does that actually mean? And so,
well, you got to get someone else to believe it. So there has to be a certain level of charisma. But you know, every time I see any of this, I just flash back to the snake oil salesman. You know, how is it any different? And I know a lot of people who distrust everything that comes from the medical establishment, but are totally willing to believe any random person they see on the internet who's making claims about some product. And I don't understand it, because who is it that's actually trying to get your money? It's usually the random person on the internet.
Yeah, and or who is trying to make you believe something just because they are saying it's true. I mean, that's like sort of the cult-like tactics that that a lot of people use to lure you in. I mean, look, we have RFK Jr. spouting all of these things about how about autism
That have
the
been
scientists
disproven. Yeah.
yes have disproven over
Yeah.
and over and over again, and but he doesn't care, so there's an element of that. These people like him, people in the wellness industry, people who want in the beauty industry, there's a lot of bad actors, and it's very hard to parse out as an adult. So
Yeah.
if it's so hard for us to parse that out as an adult, then it's even a gazillion times harder for our teenagers. And
Absolutely.
so I found that, really, fascinating. And, and I started really thinking about, just sort of like a cult leader in the wellness and beauty industry and what that would look like in the teenage world. Because I've always been fascinated by cults and why people are drawn to them. And then when you start doing the overlap of the story, when I started doing it, like, oh, okay, that these are, you have to have an author, I can't say the word.
Authoritarian.
Thank you. Authoritarian, in charge, who is not allowing you to make any, anything critical, who doesn't want any pushback. You have to listen to everything that they say. There's no other way around what they say because they're always right. And then you start questioning yourself. And that's a lot of what happened, in my book. And then and You Belong to Me, Frances Bean, the main character, she really is just a very typical insecure teenager who's had her share of trauma when she was a kid. Her dad was an alcoholic who died from alcoholism. Like I said, her mother's a teacher at this extremely fancy school. And, she doesn't have the greatest skin and she doesn't feel like she fits in. And then this beautiful, classically beautiful girl who happens to be the daughter of a very powerful person, is interested in her. Of course, she's like, yeah, I'm all in.
And she's not extraordinarily vulnerable, she's
No.
just sort of average vulnerable. She
Yes.
has
Yes.
a good home, she has a
Yes.
good mom, a good
Yeah.
and friends. She's not, so that's what's interesting to me, that how it wasn't just like somebody totally on the edges of society
No.
who gets
No, and
drawn
I
into
think that
this.
that's like any of us. I mean, think about it, just even the smallest ways possible. I'm scrolling on TikTok in the middle of the night because I can't sleep, and then someone's trying to sell me this bottle of, something like a drink that has acidophilus in it and, probiotics, and it's going to help me sleep. It's going to help my stomach. It's going to be great for perimenopause. I'm like, click, and I buy immediately. And I'm like, well informed. And all of a sudden, all these boxes start ending up on my front, porch, and my husband's like, what is this? I'm like, oh, that's a middle of the night TikTok purchase.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Haley Krischer, author of You Belong to Me. So, Haley, I wanted to ask, so your first book was an adult novel?
No,
No.
my
Okay.
first book was a young adult novel called Something Happened to Allie Greenleaf,
Okay.
and that came out in October 2020, right during the pandemic. And that was about a young girl who is sexually assaulted by the most popular boy in school, and then he convinces one of his female best friends to tell Allie that this actually didn't happen, and so it's actually based on a rape case that happened in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, which also happens to be the town that I live in now currently. But it happened in 1989. And so that was my first book. And then my second book is called The Falling Girls. And though it's about cheerleaders and sort of it's really about friendship, this friendship breakup, this very intense friendship breakup, and sort of kind of the clique of girls and how these intense friendships can kind of go wrong, and it's and how hurt we are by friendships, how hurt we can be by friendships when we're teenagers or adults,
Or
because
adults,
women,
I was gonna say. Yeah, I've had some friendship breakups, and it's like not easy at any time.
it's not, no. And so this was about this was that was The Falling Girls was based on the murder of Skylar Neese, who was murdered by two of her best friends. And it's like I always thought to myself, why would they kill her? Why couldn't they just stop being friends with her? So it's very loosely based on that, but there are things that happen in this book that are based on that. And then my third book is Where Are You, Echo Blue, which is what I talked about, the famous child star from the 90s and the obsessed journalist. And this is my fourth book, You Belong to
Okay,
Me.
okay. So why did you start writing for young adults?
You know, it's really funny. I really seem to like to write about teenagers. I sort of like to get into the teenage brain. All of my books have teenagers in them, and I'm just kind of, I mean, I have a 16-year-old daughter, but I started writing about teenage girls long before I had her. And I think just my, intense friendships with women and how important my female friendships have always been to me, probably inspired me to start writing about, going deeper into these relationships, because in all of my books, there's always these very intense friendships. And I'm always looking at sort of the psychology of those friendships. And so I think the first book, Something Happened to Allie Greenleaf, I didn't realize that it was YA, and I think that my agent and I, we thought this could go either way. This could be adult or this could be YA. And I think because there's some hope in that book, and I think that YA books, you have to have an element of hope, which you don't have to have in an adult book.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think that we just thought let's go in the YA direction, because this seems like the right way to go. And in fact, the editor who bought that book said to me, why didn't you try to sell this as an adult book? And I think at the time I wasn't still even sure of that answer. I think at the time I thought, oh, this could be an adult book. I think because it was about a teenager, we just sort of went in that direction, even though we knew it could have a crossover or, and so I think I just felt strongly about it being for teenagers at that point, until she really said it, what sort of what we were already thinking.
Well, it seems like YA books can move into. Can attract a lot of adult readers anyway.
Yeah.
And maybe not as much the other way. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think both, because my daughter, like I said, who's 16, I mean, she's certainly reading adult books. She loves Taylor Jenkins Reid. She's reading Call Me By Your Name right now. So she was reading a range of adult books. She loved Bunny by Mona Awad. And so, which is also one of my favorite books. And and I think that there's tons, and of course there's tons of adults who read YA. I think my books are there's a lot of adult women who read my books, which I really appreciate, because I think that no matter what the ages are, and this is what I've kind of come to realize, is no matter what the ages are, the story you anybody could relate to it.
Absolutely.
And no matter what time of your life that you're in.
Yeah. Haley, why don't you read a little bit from You Belong to Me?
Okay. I would love to. Okay, I'm just going to start from the first chapter. Okay, You Belong to Me. Chapter one, you could say it all started with this invitation, a thick white card popping out of my locker door. Frances Bean Ellis, deep requests your presence on the fall equinox when the sun shines directly on the equator, the Patterson home, dress code white. Girls like me don't get invitations to deep events. Girls like me aren't supposed to be interested in beauty serums, namaste hands, mindfulness apps, crystal water bottles, and the expensive white lace dresses that everyone wears who is adjacent to wellness guru Dina Patterson. Especially not me, Frances Bean Ellis, the teacher's daughter. Yes, I'm named after that Frances Bean, as in Frances Bean Cobain, Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love's daughter. My mom liked, at least according to legend, that they graced her with a middle name after a character in The Beans of Egypt, Maine by Carolyn Shute, which, according to my mom, is an excellent book on poverty in America. My friends call me Bean. Most of the girls in my school and their mothers want to be in close proximity to Dina and her daughter, Julia. Deep is a multi-million dollar wellness company with international recognition, a billionaire fan base, and a flagship store right here in South Brent because Dina Patterson, who lives in a palatial home in the estate section, wanted a short commute. But Deep isn't just wellness. It's clean beauty products, organic clothes, detox brushes, salt therapies, and new ways to heal yourself. Then about 5 years ago, Dina Patterson launched Femme, an exclusive offshoot for young girls. Femme girls host parties or gatherings, as they call them. They intern at the local Deep store and are regulars on the Deep Instagram account. All of them in their white dresses and lacy skirts, draping their glowy legs on white ruffled organic linen sheets, surrounded by an endless supply of cosmetics and products. Girls with huge smiles on their faces, looking like someone vacuumed the brains out of their skulls. I could barely afford a hair tie from the Deep store. The reason I want to be in close proximity to Julia Patterson has nothing to do with Deep or Femme. It's because I've been crushing on Julia long before we became partners in 19th century lit. Yes, me, with my overdyed platinum blonde hair, my red lips, my white ghostly skin, my unplucked, messy dark brows, my black velvet skirt, my embroidered top with the lace sleeves, my fishnet stockings. I'm supposed to rebel against such things, yet I have a crush on Julia Patterson, a wild, out-of-control crush. I heard about these invitations, but I thought it was like folklore or something, Brooks says, and plucks the card from the crease of my locker, turning it over to inspect it. Say what you want about Brooks, that his pompadour hair, penny loafers, and black rim glasses make him look like a young Morrissey, which he vehemently denies, by the way, but he's a fiercely loyal friend. Ivy pokes Brooks with her black lace parasol, reaches her lace glove fingers out, and snatches the invite from his hands. The parasol was something she picked up at an antique shop during a weekend trip to London with her mom about a year ago, and she's carried it with her ever since. Out of our group, Ivy is my best friend. Damn, Bean, this happened fast, Ivy said. You bonded with Julia Patterson over Charlotte Bronte, and now you've got an invite? Hand it over, Nico says, and inspects the invitation with her antique gold magnifying pendant, an artifact she wears around her neck. Embossed lettering? 120-pound cardstock? Jesus, this is wedding invite quality. Might as well be an invite to a coronation with the massive social currency it carries, at least to the people in this school, Brooks says. He's not wrong. Tulentum is an elite private school 12 miles out of Manhattan. Countless articles have been written about the student body, how rich they are, how they skip out on required community service, how the anti-racist missions have largely gone ignored. Tulentum may come with a high price tag, but it's got a glare of privilege shining on it. While the kids at Talentum are the power elite of the world, my friends and I, in our Victorian goth attire, are most certainly the outcasts. The only reason I go to Talentum is because my mother is a teacher here. The only other school I've gone to was a neighborhood public school in the West Village, where my mom and I lived in a studio apartment. My bedroom was a walk-in closet. Ivy always tells me that I have the right to be here more than anyone because my mom has influenced over a decade's worth of students with her feminist-focused history lessons. Yet, I don't belong here is always in the back of my mind, which is why this invite makes little sense. Why would Julie Patterson invite me? Can we get back to this invitation? Brooke says. Yeah, I thought you two were just friendly in class, Ivy says. Is this like a full-blown thing? Calm down. It's just an invite, I say. There's nothing full-blown about it. But I don't feel calm at all, and I'm starting to wonder if it was accidentally put in my locker. Though, how can it be accidental? It has my name on it. Maybe, just maybe, Julia knows about my crush and has one on me, too. No, that's impossible. I tell my friends I'll meet them in the newsroom after class, and I give them details, and I'll give them updates with details, always with details. And I'm reminded of the invitation again, all those details on the fall equinox, when the sun shines directly on the equator, and an excitement creeps up my spine to my shoulders, through my ears, and I shiver as I walk into class.
And that was Haley Kreischer reading from You Belong to Me. So it's interesting because when I was reading the book, I didn't realize you were a classical literature major. And so they're bonding in this 19th century literature class studying Jane Eyre.
Yes.
And so what are some of the kind of the concepts from Jane Eyre that influence or that come into the story?
You know, well, it's really funny. I just have to say first that I hadn't read Jane Eyre until a couple of years ago, which is
me
just
neither. Same.
I'm so glad that you're saying that. Because I felt like I was crazy. Like everybody had read Jane Eyre, especially if you were an English major in college. My God. And isn't it such a great book?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I don't think I actually read it. I think I listened to it on Audible. But
okay.
But yeah, it is.
I mean, Charlotte Bronte was just so ahead of her time because, you know, Jane Eyre, if you haven't read it, definitely please go pick it up. But it's all about a girl who is you know, stuck in this world that she feels like she can't get out of. It's a Victorian era world. And she, you know, is completely true to herself. She speaks her mind. She tells the truth. She refuses to, you know, bend to sort of society, you know, and she really, she practices free will, which is one of the themes in my book, is like practicing, you know, especially when you're getting manipulated by a cult leader. You know, in Jane Eyre, the cult leader is the patriarchy, you know, and so she is making decisions for herself, whether or not she should marry somebody, even though people are telling her to, whether or not she should be in love with, you know, someone who is, she knows isn't, you know, has a checkered past. You know, she lives in this house where, and I don't think this is a spoiler since it was written a couple of years ago.
I know. We all know about the mad woman in the attic.
Okay, good. I mean, and you know, I really started thinking about, you know, the mad woman in the attic because I had read I saw the movie The Wide Sargasso Sea, which is a telling of Bertha, the mad woman in the attic, her story and her origin story. Mm-hmm. And I believe that was written in the 1960s, and it was about how she wasn't this mad woman in the attic. She was a woman who was basically like stolen, you know, and promised all of these things by this Englishman, Rochester, And then when she didn't comply, she was stuck in the attic. And so I was, you know, really fascinated by how, okay, I'm writing about sort of, you know, these cult member manipulations, and how, you know, Jane Eyre is, you know, discovering that there's this woman living in the attic, and she's being told that this woman is up there because she's, you know, quote unquote, insane. What if she's not insane? What if she is just, you know, defending her life? What if she is just doesn't want to be a prisoner to this world? And I realized that that was such a huge overlap with what I wanted to write about, because that is often what happens in a cult. You start to doubt all of your instincts. You know, everything in your life is turned upside down. If you want to leave, you're told that you're crazy. And you're treated, you know, basically, you know, a lot of these cults are, unfortunately, women are, you know, sexually abused, and children especially are sexually abused. And I think that it had so many overlaps. And so I thought, wow, I want these girls to be reading Jane Eyre. And then the two of them, Julia, while Julia is, who's the daughter of the wellness guru, who I believe is probably the one of the biggest victims in this story, because she has been told this lie by her mother her entire life and fully believes it because she knows nothing else, you know, and she draws all these other girls into this quote unquote cult, into her mother's wellness company, because she thinks it's safe and she thinks it's great and she thinks it's going to help people. But in fact, her mother is, you know, this horrible person, you know, all along. And so I wanted Julia and Bean to sort of have these realizations as they're reading Jane Eyre. And I thought that would, you know, and that's, I guess, what sort of, you know, I guess you could make something like that as an adult book. It doesn't have to be YA, but I thought this really works for YA because, you know, Jane Eyre is a young girl.
Right,
you know,
right.
She's
and
a teenager.
And it's not uncommon to be studying that book in high school.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right, exactly. So that was really fun for me.
I bet.
To do that.
I bet.
Yeah, it was really fun. And especially because I felt so inspired by reading Jane Eyre. She's the original rebellious teenager. I mean.
You know, I think, you know, I also started Wuthering Heights, but I didn't like that nearly as much. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I think they're making a movie out of Wuthering Heights right now with Jacob Elordi and somebody else. I'm not sure who else, but yeah.
Yeah, it might. I mean, obviously those books have stood the test of time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do you ever, you know, having studied these classics and then becoming a writer, do you have a hope that maybe you'll write a book that will stand, that will still be read 200 years from now?
Oh my God. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite books, two of my favorite books are classics. Madame Bovary, which I think is, you know, one of those books that is just incredibly, it can be misunderstood. I think that Emma Bovary is, you know, if you don't know what it's about this woman who is also a victim of the patriarchy. And
are we sensing a theme here?
We're sensing a theme. She is, I mean, that was written by a man, Flaubert, but it was, you know, I mean, he tells such an incredible story about, it's almost like a Rosemary's Baby kind of, you know, in a way where she's just, you know, she's stuck in this world and she's just dying to get out of it. She just wants to, well, not really like Rosemary's Baby, but she wants, you know, the idea that she is being so manipulated by everybody around her. And she's just clamoring to just get out of this world because she wants so much more for herself. And I've always found her as such a likable character, even though everyone hates Emma Bovary because she's just a, you know, she cheats on her husband. She lies. She, her poor daughter is in destitute because she like made all these horrible choices. But I just felt like, well, you could be a victim and a victimizer. And I think that that's also something that I explored in You Belong to Me, because the cult members, they were really told a lie, about their world and manipulated very much like the Manson sisters. That story, the Charles Manson, those murders really influenced me in writing this book, especially Emma Klein's book, The Girls, because it comes from the perspective of one of the girls in the cult. Have you ever read that book?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's amazing. It's very dark. But it is about, it's a retelling sort of the Manson murders, and it's from the perspective of this girl who joins that cult, obviously not knowing what's happening, but she's just so enamored by that life and wants so badly to be part of it and to belong to that world that she's kind of just willing to ignore everything in her life because she's just kind of just floating. And so it's
the need to belong is really a powerful force, isn't it?
It is a powerful force, because I think that you don't listen to your own instincts when you feel that need. And for Frances Bean, my main character, that's that drive, is really about that need to sort of belong. And like you said, she's like a, her mother is this responsible person who's super caring. But she just still always feels like an outsider. And so I think any book that I write, I would love to be able to just take a concept that, can exist over time now or in 200 years from now.
You were saying that Madame Bovary was one of your favorite books, and the other classic that's your favorite. I'm curious.
Oh yeah. Howard's End by E.M. Forster.
Yeah.
Because that is another book that is all about classes. It's all about social economic status. It's about how wealthy people are ignoring sort of the plight of the poor, and how wealthier people just want to continue getting wealthier, how the middle class is getting squeezed, and how poor people are in England in the 1800s and London are just completely ignored. And oh my God, it's like, well, isn't that the story that's being told today? It's the same exact story, where you have these incredibly rich, wealthy men who get away with murder sometimes. And so the core of that story is about these two sisters, and one goes into one direction of really feeling the plight of people who are economically struggling, and this couple who are in poverty, and how important that is in her world as a upper middle class woman in society. And then the other sister sort of goes into the direction of how of a wealthy family, and she falls in love with this very wealthy man, and she's and it's sort of this conflict between these two extremely progressive sisters. And how they manage these worlds, and are they able to sort of bring it back together after a lot of chaos ensues? I don't want to give anything away, because there's so many plot twists in Howard's End, and I really don't want to give anything away. But it's such an amazing book, and it was actually a movie.
It was
in
a
the
movie,
90s.
Yeah.
And
was the movie? Did the movie do it justice?
Oh, the movie's so beautiful.
I think I watched it back then, but that was a long time ago, and I need to watch that again.
Oh, Helena Bonham Carter, Emma Thompson, and
was it Andrew Hopkins?
Anthony Hopkins.
Yes.
Plays the terrible rich man. And it's so good. It's so beautiful. It was directed by those men who did all of those beautiful classic movies. And
oh,
the,
right,
and
right,
the,
right. Yes.
I can't remember their names in a second. And then it was also remade into a television show on PBS not too long ago, just a couple of years ago. And I, the actor who plays Tom from Succession played the terrible rich man. I'm lost on what his name was.
That's okay. I'm gonna have to look for that. I'll have to
look
for
that. Yeah, but
it's
excellent. Very different than the movie. Not as dreamy as the movie, but very, very, very much about, you know, how do we sit if you're a person who has money in your life, how do you deal with people who do not? And how, you know,
you know,
it's wild.
This has always been one of my I have a background as a tax preparer for many years, and also have a background in manufacturing and industry. And one of the things that I always felt about paying taxes was that I'm actually happy to pay a fair amount of tax, knowing that it's going to help people, because otherwise I would feel responsible for everybody. And, you know, I would feel guilty about having so much more than many people do, and feel like I would need to figure out a way. And I don't, that would be way too hard to figure out a way to help everybody. And knowing that our government has programs in place, a social safety net, relieves me of the burden of having to figure that out.
You know what? It's such a great way to put that. I really like, you know, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because our, you know, when you look at your taxes, you're like, okay, this is going to the schools. This is going to this, this is going to the roads. Who's supposed to pay for these things otherwise?
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand people who say no government at all. I mean, it's bananas to me.
It is bananas. Anyway, we won't get too political, although we certainly could, but I do want to talk to you a little bit about your writing process.
Yeah.
Now, when you're starting a book, do you know what's going to happen before you start writing, or does that come out of the writing?
I think I've known like what was going to happen in all of the YA books, and in something happened in Where Are You, Echo Blue. That was the one book I didn't entirely know what was going to happen, because at the end of the book, in my original draft that we sold to Dutton, I wanted somebody to end up in a basement, locked in a basement. I was really like going into like Mad Woman over the edge in that book. And one of the characters really goes into, you know, she's really on the verge. My editor before she bought it said, I just have an issue with one thing in this book that I want to know if you'll be able to change. We can't have this character locked in the basement. I don't think it works. And I was like, no, I want her to be locked in the basement. But you know, it sort of like goes back to like that whole kill your darlings, because it's the idea of that, okay, well, does this work for the story? Is it just working for Haley?
Yeah.
You know, I'm entertained by this, fascinated by this character getting locked in the basement, but it doesn't necessarily mean it works for my story. And so you have to, you know, a good editor will help you with that. But I think also you have to, so I sometimes have the ending, and sometimes I have a different ending.
Do you have all of the characters in mind when you start writing?
I think yes and no. You know, I try my best to do what Anne Lamott said, which is to in Bird by Bird, which is
that's my favorite book on writing.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Yeah.
The shitty first draft.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of the gold standard, because then you're just kind of getting everything out there. It's not necessarily good, But then you can delve more into your characters and, yeah, and sort of have an idea about what you want to do with them. So, you know, for the Falling Girls, for instance, you know, I definitely was confused about, there is a murderer, as I told you, it was based on a, about this murder of this young girl, Skylar Neese, who was killed by two of her friends. And I was very confused about who the murderer was. Because I loved the girls all so much. And so one day I made one girl a murderer. The next day I make the next girl a murderer. and I won't tell you who it is, but I just, when you start to love your characters, you don't want them to, especially the teenage girls, you don't necessarily want them to go down that road, because you're like, no, please don't be rational. Please don't have anything to do with this. I beg you.
But if
and
you,
I really
but you wouldn't have had a book
so much
if you'd kept them from
somebody
doing that.
Somebody had to be the murderer.
Yeah.
Somebody had to do it.
So do you tend to start with the concept and then the character, or character and then concept?
Yeah, I'd start with the concept, I think.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe not with, maybe Allie Greenleaf, because I started writing it in college as a short story. I think I was just doing sort of a character study about this one girl. And so that was, the concept was that she was sexually assaulted by this boy who she had an enormous crush on, and who was the most popular kid in school. So that was the concept, but she also was the person who was going to have to deal with this situation. And so I just kept writing her and writing her and writing her. But I think, you know, you writing a book over 20 years is, I mean, you could do it. I wouldn't recommend it. Some books, you know, I mean, some books take 10 years. Some books take a long time. I have a friend who is an author, and she said to me, no, if I'm writing a book too long, goodbye. I'm done with that. You know?
So you
because
your
you
first book
money,
was published in 2020?
Yes. 2020.
And now you're on your fourth. So that's pretty good, you know.
It is pretty good.
Yeah. Just real quick, was it hard to get that first one published?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really, really hard. Because it was, I probably had like about 13 rejections, and then all of a sudden more. And then there was like probably 18 to 20 rejections. And then I just kept going back and revising. And I really thought, okay, this is not going to get sold. This is just, I'm not going to be an author. I'm going to be a journalist, and that's fine. I'm writing for the New York Times. This is great. Everything's going to be okay. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking about this story, Allie Greenleaf. And then the Brett Kavanaugh case came out, and his trial happened, you know, with the Supreme Court. And I realized, oh my God, one of the main characters, who is the assaulter in the book, I realized that he would be Brett Kavanaugh grown up.
Oh wow!
You know, the
oh,
most
wow.
popular
yeah,
boy
yeah,
in school.
Yep. Yep.
And got away with it. And, you know, now is going to be a Supreme Court justice. And that was literally happening before my eyes. And I called my agent, and she's like, I was just about to call you. And I said, I think it's time to resend out this book, because people were sort of afraid to deal with this. You know, there's a chapter in Something Happened to Allie Greenleaf, just for a trigger warning. There's a chapter or two that are very graphic sexual assault scenes. And so, you know, people weren't quite ready for that. But once the Brett Kavanaugh trial came out, the book sold in like 3 days.
Oh, wow.
So I went from 5 years of rejections to 3 days.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you, Haley, for being with us today. We're out of time. And
okay.
For listeners, Haley Krischer, You Belong to Me. Our closing quote today is from Leo Tolstoy. It is amazing how complete is the delusion that beauty is goodness.
That's an amazing quote. Thank you so much for having me.
You're
this
very
so
welcome.
Amazing.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.